Welcome to another episode of The Watchdog with me, Low Key. We are here on Mint Press, as you know, weekly going against the grain and covering the stories which are regularly marginalized outside of the earshot and the eyesight of the masses. And this week we have a very special episode with a legendary figure, Gade Karmi, who is not only somebody that lived through and was displaced by the Nakba, but she's also an academic physician and author, and has contributed some important texts to the Palestinian struggle from London, from her life today in London. I've been fortunate enough to share a platform with Gade at the Oxford Union, where actually we pulverized the opposition in our debate. And that was a very pleasant experience for me. Gade, thank you so much for joining us today on The Watchdog.
Pleasure. It's a pleasure.
And to start with, Gade, if you could just tell us, what was your experience of the Nakba? You know, we understand the Nakba is something continuous, but what was your experience in 1948?
Well, first of all, people have to understand I was a child, and my memories aren't very clear, not very good. But somehow, even though I was a child, I kind of sensed that something terrible was happening to us. Nobody prepared us. I mean, my parents were extremely alarmed and worried, and you know, and that worried me. But they didn't sit us down and say, look, children, you know, we're going away for a short while, which is what they believed anyway, and we'll soon be back. Don't worry. It'll be all right. None of that. And so they were agitated, and that communicated itself to me. But in my case, I didn't know why they were agitated, and therefore it was even worse, because you feel a sense of doom and fear that you don't know what of. So it was a really very bad experience. And we left our home in Jerusalem, and which was very, very hard, because a lot of people were leaving. Jewish militias had taken over our neighborhood, and they were shooting at people. It was simply terrifying. So we had to find a taxi that was willing to come to our neighborhood because it was so dangerous. We finally found a taxi, which was extremely decrepit. And I suppose if I'd been an adult, my thought would have been, will he ever make it? But we did. He drove us one suitcase, three children, two adults. So it was pretty full, this taxi. And we arrived at the bus station in the old city of Jerusalem, where loads of taxis were around taking people away from what was considered a war zone. So really, that's how it happened. But the thing that I really remember, you know, was extraordinary. For a child, I thought that as we left the house, and we left our dog, family dog, whom we loved dearly, we had to leave him. I had a premonition that we would never come back. And really, it was very sad. And we ended up in my grandfather's house in Damascus, much better than many other people, by the way. But it doesn't really help if you're thinking that you've lost everything. In my case, a few short years of life. In my parents' case, their whole life. You know, it's a momentous event.
And if you don't mind me asking, how do you feel are some of the ways in which that trauma went on to manifest in the lives of your relatives and possibly even your parents?
Oh, no, there's no doubt about it, because the trauma that people suffered at the time was clear from the way people behaved. Now, if you take my parents, for example, for years, they never talked about Palestine. You know, you hear these stories about refugee camps where the elders of the camp will talk to the small children about their home village and what it was like. There was nothing like that in our place. We ended up in England, so we were displaced twice. First to Damascus, second to London. Now, the thing that made me realize things weren't normal was the way they would not talk about it. They didn't talk about how they felt. They didn't talk about the lives that they had hoped to have, or about contemporaries, or about friends, what happened to them, etc. So I think that that's a very vivid way to show how people felt. And when I think, you know, that one of the little publicized aspects of the Nakba, it was the severance of human ties, so that people who had been your neighbors or your friends or your employers somehow disappeared. Because in the rush to save one's family and the rest of it, where were those people? And in so often happened, they were never reclaimed. Those people went, don't know where, and they didn't know where we'd gone. And that is an aspect of this eviction from our homeland, which is very significant. And as I say, isn't often talked about. Now, in my own case, there was a village woman who used to help my mother in the house. I loved her dearly. She was called Fatima. And we never knew what happened to her. We had to leave her behind. She couldn't come with us. And we thought we were coming back anyway. So my father said to her, look after the house, mind, because we won't be long. And of course, we were never allowed back. And we lost touch with her. And the reason I mention her is because for me, as a child, she was a very important figure. And hence my memoir, In Search of Fatima. The Fatima of the title is this woman.
Thank you for that, Rada. Now, we were supposed to have a conversation about your new book with something called the Balfour Project. Now, we were unceremoniously cancelled, and you've written a piece in Novara Media about that. Could you break down what exactly happened? How come the launch never went ahead?
Well, as you say, we were due to do an event whose purpose really was a book launch for my book, One State. And this was all set up. And then the night before the event was supposed to happen, the night before, I got a phone call telling me it was off. Just like that. Now, I found out that the reason it had been cancelled was you, Loki, not me, apparently. There were anxieties on the part of a Zionist organization called YACAD. They were very concerned that you were anti-Semitic, and they expressed their concerns to one of the members of the executive committee of the Balfour Project on the evening before. And he seems to have caved in. He didn't argue. He didn't even ask on what basis, on what grounds are you accusing this man of being anti-Semitic. Didn't ask, and just simply went ahead and without any hesitation threw both of us under the bus. Why? Because they feared to offend this Zionist organization called Yahad. And it turned out that they do have some collaborations. I think it's on educational matters or something like that. But even a tenuous connection like that with a Zionist organization was enough for them to ditch us and mollify the Zionists. Now, that really made me extremely angry. It really made me angry because there were so many things they could have done. For a start, the man they contacted could have said to them, this event has been advertised for the last 2 to 3 weeks. Why do you phone us at the last possible minute? Unfortunately, it's too late. We cannot cancel our speakers. And afterwards, you know, he could have sort of said, and we'll look into it or something. That's in fact what he should have done. And the fact that he didn't do it, I thought was quite significant. I really did. And that's why I wrote the article. It's not just a matter of an incident where a supposed Palestinian supporter cuts and runs in fear of the Zionists. You will get that happening from that time. Point is, what does it signify? It signifies to me that keeping the favor of Zionists, albeit these are liberal Zionists, keeping them happy was more important than keeping me and you happy. So we were ditched, and the relationship with this organization was saved. Now, how many times have we had something similar where a Zionist objects or a Zionist group objects, and people become very alarmed and are very anxious to appease the Zionist organization? This has happened many times. It means something.
Absolutely. I think a key text in understanding this policy, which has been aimed at this country, particularly in a more sharp and acute way since Corbynism, but previous to that, of course, it's well documented that the Zionist movement has practiced these kind of tactics across the board in many different countries. But a key text to understanding, particularly the London context, is the Roy Institute's study of London as a hub of delegitimization of Israel that was published in 2011. Now, this text designates supporters of Palestine in two ways, and it suggests different tactics for each of these designations. So the first designation is criticizers, who the Roy Institute says can be engaged through sophisticated engagement strategies. The other designation that the Roy Institute lists is delegitimizers, who must be attacked and sabotaged wherever possible. Now, it's my belief, and I'll explain why, that both Yahad and the Balfour Project are part of these sophisticated engagement strategies, which are about pulling in critics and attempting to push them in a direction of sort of gentle normalization. And I'll explain where I'm coming from with this point of view. So, for instance, if we look at Yahad, in their website, they claim that their purpose is to work with organizations that, quote unquote, fight the occupation. It's, of course, important to remember that Yahad is part of the Board of Deputies which itself, in its own trustees report of 2020, this is post the killing of Corbynism, it states that it has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, and the IDF spokesman's department. We know that across the years, Yechad has regularly been given briefings by former heads, particularly of Shin Bet and Shabak, Israeli intelligence agencies, generally the internal ones. We also know that Yechad speaks openly of working with political partners within the Zionist entity. And within its own trustees report, it also makes a great deal of the fact that two of its former fellows are now on the National Council of the Zionist Federation. Yechad also claims that it works with the Yesha Council. Now, the Yesha Council is the umbrella organization for all illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. So how can Yechad simultaneously claim that it's anti-occupation and anti-settlement while actually stating that it works with the umbrella organization of the settlements? We also know that its board has formally featured a former employee of the Israeli embassy, Ella Rose, who caused quite a lot of chaos within the Labour Party with her activities there as part of the JLM. You can read more about Ella Rose's activities on the Electronic Intifada, for example. You have several figures on the Yechad board that have links to not only Israel lobby groups, but also even Israeli intelligence think tanks like INSS. You also have other examples where Yechad has worked with one of Israel's state institutions, the United Jewish Israel Appeal, which is a key funder of Israel. Literally, the chair of Yechad, Simon Shady, was the founding chair of the UJIA business division. Now, the UJIA has been found to take people on trips to settlements within the West Bank. And what you also have is an interesting relationship, and this will come back when we talk about the Balfour Project, between Yechad and an organization by the name of the Piers Foundation. Now, the Piers Foundation also funds Yechad, but the current chair of Yechad, and actually director, sorry, of Yechad, Hannah Weisfeld, formerly was a consultant to the Piers Foundation. Now, the Piers Foundation is headed by a gentleman that not only was a director of BICOM, the Israel lobby group, but also is a key funder of the Conservative Party. This is Trevor Piers. So interestingly, this organization, which claims to be liberal or even leftist, is actually funded by a large donor to the Conservative Party. What we also have to remember is that the Piers Foundation funds the office costs for the New Israel Fund, which unfortunately actually funds some allegedly pro-Palestinian organizations. But the New Israel Fund shares the office in Kentish Town with Yechad. You know, the story really goes on. But as I say, Yechad seems like an instrument through which criticizers can be subject to sophisticated engagement, as they call it. But then if we look at and we pick apart the relationship between Yechad and the Balfour Project, it also reveals some quite interesting things. So, you know, key figures at the Balfour Project, like Vincent Fine, you know, he was the British ambassador to Libya, of course, but parallel and simultaneous, actually, to his role at the Balfour Project, Vincent Fine was working for a private intelligence firm called MS Risk, which supposedly works on reducing the impact of direct and indirect terrorist threats, quote unquote. And the CEO of that organization, MS Risk, Liam Morrissey, was also simultaneously a colonel in the British Army. But the key part where it brings into question whether the Balfour Project is part of this sophisticated engagement strategy, not only does it, you know, fairly regularly has it hosted former Israeli government figures like ambassadors, but also the programs manager at the Balfour project is someone by the name of Martha Scott Cracknell. Now, she is simultaneous to working as the programs manager at the Balfour Project, a project manager at the normalization operation, FODIP, the Forum for Discussion of Israel-Palestine. Now, FODIP is also funded by the Piers Foundation, by Trevor Piers, this donor to the Tory party and this key figure in the Israel lobby. And then another interesting part of what the Balfour Project has done is that it employs someone called Matten Rosenstrach as a consultant to quote-unquote strengthen their engagement with the Jewish community. Now, at the same time as Matten Rosenstrach works for the Balfour Project, he also works for the Israeli political party Meretz. Now, Meretz was part of the coalition with Naftali Bennett. So at the same time as Meretz was a governing party of Israel, it had one of its employees working for this pro-Palestinian organization, the Balfour Project. So, you know, there's a lot to question, in my opinion, about what exactly this organization, which says it doesn't want the British government to apologize for the Balfour declaration, that it's an education organization. It actually says on its own documents, the Balfour Project, which are obviously in Scotland, because that's where it's registered, on its own documents, it says it's about conflict resolution. And we both know that conflict resolution is essentially a way of saying normalization in the present time that we find ourselves, unfortunately. But anyway, that's enough about these organizations, which frankly are becoming more and more obvious in their aims by the day. And you know, this situation, and I thank you for the stand that you took, Rada, because it's essential that we stand together and we say clearly we know who we are, and we don't need you to tell us who stands with the Palestinians. Go ahead, sorry.
Yes, just one comment. First of all, they did offer me, that's the Balfour Project, they offered me another chance to have an event for my book, but they were not going to have you. And that's at that moment, I said, no, forget it. And anyway, you know, it's out of the question. But I was wanting to say something about your extremely thorough information about Yachad and its connections, and it's the connection with the Israeli embassy and the Israeli state. You see, in a way, that's not the main point as far as I'm concerned. These organizations are welcome to link up with the Israeli embassy, with the Shabak, with Mossad, whoever they want to link up with. That's fine for them. There's no problem about that. The problem arises when organizations claim to be supporting the Palestinian cause. That's where the problem really arises. Because other than a claim like that, the Balfour Project, supposing the Balfour Project said, we want to encourage liberal Zionist groups, for example, in changing the views of the conflict, that kind of thing, they're perfectly welcome to do that. And they're welcome to make links and contacts with Yachad and others who are similarly inclined. That's also not the problem. The issue is if an organization or an individual says that they are pro-Palestinian, that they care about the Palestinians, that they want to support their cause, it's at that point that we have a problem. Because you cannot, in my view, and that was the subject matter of the article, you cannot support Palestinians or their cause if you have connections with Zionists, whether they're liberal or not liberal, it doesn't matter. Connections with Zionists, with the idea that you can actually work on some projects together, is not part of being a supporter of Palestinians. And that was really the thing that made me very angry. You see, remember one other thing about the Balfour Project. They're pretty well funded, and many of their funders are Arabs. So Arabs are funding this project in the belief, clearly, that it's promoting the Palestine cause, when actually it's not, as we've shown, as this case has shown. So that's where if I could call it skullduggery, comes in.
Wow. And perhaps that's something to revisit at a later date. Of course, that's very important information. Now, Ghada, would you be able to tell us about your new book and how it relates to your previous work, Married to Another Man, which came out in 2007, please?
Well, my new book is called One State, the Only Democratic Future for Palestine Israel. It is, in fact, based on an earlier book, Married to Another Man, as you say, which talked about the one state solution. But it was also about other things, that book. So what I did this time was to focus on the one state idea. What does it mean? What are the drawbacks, setbacks for it? What are the obstacles? What are the good things to be said about it? That kind of thing. And so that's really what I did. It's an in-depth look at what do we mean by one state? Is it a good idea or what? Can it happen? If so, how? Those questions, which I think are really, really crucially important. And very often, you know, you get people who, in a well-meaning way, support the idea of one state where the two peoples can live together, etc., etc. But they don't really, they haven't really thought through what that would involve and what it would mean. So in a way, I hope that this book would answer those sorts of questions.
And of course, the necessity of establishing something like this would be an understanding that Zionism, or that this, as Yusuf al-Kabir, an Iraqi lawyer in the 30s, described it, this militant archaeology, which says that somebody in Canada or somebody in Brooklyn or somebody in Hampstead Heath has the right to come and take a Palestinian home, this idea essentially needs to be permanently discredited for a kind of higher universalism in a way. And what's your prognosis of how likely that can be achieved within a kind of society that has been established within, you know, the Zionist entity?
Very difficult. I mean, first of all, we have to be honest about this. We cannot underestimate the difficulties of making such a thing happen. But, you know, all the building blocks are already there. It's just a matter of putting them together. I tell you what I mean. If you look at the territory between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, what do you find? You find that it is one territory under one ruler, and the ruler is the state of Israel. So there is no two states anyway. There is one state already. Now, the issue here is not that you'd have to make any geographic changes. The issue is the way that the state of Israel rules this one territory. We know that it imposes an apartheid regime, that it is an oppressor, that it deprives the Palestinian half of all its rights, and yet remains in place as a ruler. So if I could just quickly also say, when I said there is one territory, in the territory that Israel rules, there's roughly half and half Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews. It's half and half. So we're not talking about a tiny minority of Palestinians. We are talking about it. Now, a small percentage of the Palestinians are citizens of Israel, and they have partial rights. They do have some rights, but they're not full rights. But the bulk of the Palestinians, living in this one territory have no rights at all. They have no citizenship. They have no rights. They are stateless. Now, it seemed to me to be quite obvious that in order to move forward with a situation like this, you have to work to change the government that is governing this one territory. The territory is there. The population is there. It's the way they're ruled that you have to change. And that is the thing that people should focus on. How do you do that? What actions do you have to take? And so on. And there's a big part of the book, which is devoted to precisely to trying to answer this question.
And Ghada, I understand, you know, we are running a little bit late in time, but if I could just ask you one last question. I'm not sure if you came across the Electronic Intifada piece recently published, which found that in order to train the Palestinian Authority, what has taken place is former British intelligence figures, and in some cases working for the Adam Smith Institute, are tasked with training the Palestinian Authority, and in some cases sitting in with the Palestinian Authority and helping in decision making. And what I think this points to is a sort of trilateral security state which was established, and actually the Corbyn experience is also part of this, between the Israelis, the Americans, and the British. And the role that the British play in it, I also feel that the Balfour Project is symptomatic of that, is that some of the things that Israel wishes to do are sort of outsourced and passed off to the British. So I'm not sure if you came across that story. If you didn't, I will send it to you. But if you did come across it, is there any response that you have to this revelation that Britain is intimately involved in helping, really, the suppression of Palestinian aspirations through its work with the Palestinian Authority?
Yes. I mean, I'm not surprised, no. Because we know from the start, from after the Oslo Agreement of 1993, when the Palestinian Authority was set up, early on in those days, and with the presence of Yasser Arafat, the already a police force, a Palestinian police force, was being trained at that time by the Americans, and so that was right from the beginning. The fact that there are British involved in this doesn't surprise me in the slightest, because one thing, you know, those who support Palestine and Palestinians themselves need to understand very clearly, Britain has played a very damaging role towards the Palestinians, right from when a British colonial secretary, Arthur Balfour, passed the Balfour Declaration in 1917, aiming to invite in settlers, foreign settlers. From that moment to this, Britain has not come out in even the mildest support for Palestinians, for their struggle, for the consequences of what Balfour did. And when I say Britain, I mean the establishment. I mean officials have not done that, and they won't do it. And so it's very important to bear that in mind. You cannot rely on some kind of change of heart, some miracle, which will happen, and then Britain starts to understand it has a historic responsibility for Palestine. That's not going to happen.
I think in a way the British, if we analyze them historically, they specialize in creative ambiguities. And in a way the Balfour Declaration was this sort of creative ambiguity. The British are able to project upon themselves a sort of blank slateism, which says that ultimately, we have a conscience, and ultimately, we are with you. And I think that there's been great mileage in that for this function of Britain being an outsource, opposed to outsource a lot of the functions that Israel wishes to fulfill. Of course, we know that Herbert Samuel, the first High Commissioner of Palestine for the British, that both totem poles of the Zionist movement, from Ben Gurion to Vladimir Jabotinsky, they were trained in the very same unit in the British military in World War One as Herbert Samuel's son, for example. And so these key fighters for the Zionist dream were armed and trained by the British. Of course, Ord Wingate in 36, when, you know, the Palestinians undertook the heroic strike, longest strike in recorded human history. Part of the quelling of that was Ord Wingate organizing these Zionist gangs into what would, you know, later become the Palmach and other stuff like that. But of course, that's another story for another time. Dr. Rade, thank you so much for joining us today on The Watchdog. I greatly appreciate it, and I look forward to more opportunities for us to talk further.
Thank you.